This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. My attention span gets really short in the summer. I flit from gardening to lounging to bike riding and working. And what was I saying? Short attention span. It's summer. Time for doing. It's time for being. Not time for thinking. So I'm going to follow up last week's collection of short pieces with even shorter short pieces so as not to tax our power of attention. I think we can fit maybe 15, 16 segments into the show if we get busy. So here goes. Installment number one. It comes from just before the last presidential election. The University of Idaho Women's Center hosted a panel session on gender and politics. Professor Leotona Hormel was on that panel, and she's a professor, a sociologist, at the University of Idaho in Moscow. And here's Leotina Hormel talking about how sex, race, and class was playing into the election.
And I think this is an interesting way of thinking about sexism and racism and class. You know, I like to think of all three of those and more. Sexuality in general, that they're intersecting in these very interesting ways. And Obama's sexuality gets questioned in not direct ways, but in focusing on whether he's very manly and whether and being juxtaposed. That's why it's really important to think of the Republican Party as the frontier masculinity, when really they're the business class masculinity, which no working class men would ever vote for, but but we want to be puffy-chested, frontier masculinity. And that allows them to contrast someone like Obama to them. I would say that they were not happy when Obama actually got the candidacy because Hillary was going to be an easier pick for them. And
you mean Target?
Target, yes. They could pick at her and... in a much easier way. And if you listen to the right-wing talk shows, I was painting for my parents, their bathroom, in March, and my dad was listening to Gordon Liddy on the radio and had Fox News blasting at the same time. He was worried I was alone in his bathroom painting. And so he had them both going, and I was like, oh, as if this environment's not toxic enough with the fake news. But at the time was when they were busy promoting Hillary Clinton, because they knew that her femininity would be so easy to pinpoint, again, as a classist, elitist, masculine femininity. Mm-hmm. And Obama, they knew that they could conjure him as this effeminate being, because, you know, subtly with race in there as the undertone, and also to try to make him out to be this elite person, which I think is ironic if we think of race history. And I just wanted to print out the whole debate that they had in the early August time of, is he too thin? Is he too fit to be president?
No.
So they're treating him, right? Women are very used to their appearances being scrutinized. Hillary had to be very used to that. And they're treating him the same way, which I found fascinating. I haven't seen as much of that play when you deal with Clinton, for instance. I mean, who can challenge that masculinity anyway? That might actually be one up on the frontier masculinity. So I find that those things, I think you can't disregard the intersections of these different forms of inequalities in trying to represent, without any fact, but to try to represent people in these different images and to mobilize working class men, and working class wives will feel inclined to follow, perhaps, and maybe that explains why, even though there's more women voting, they want to be like Sarah Palin and be supportive. And, you know, they don't, it's brutal to question that masculinity and that power system.
That was Leontina Hormel speaking as part of a pre-election panel on gender and politics. Another sociologist at the University of Idaho, Tracy Craig, has observed gender differences in the classroom.
This semester, I've actually been teaching a new course in environmental psychology, and it's been really interesting to see gender differences in that course in terms of how men and women respond very differently. So one of the assignments they were doing is to, I call them the elemental assignments. So they're supposed to go sort of get into a space where they're interacting with earth, wind, air, fire, and talk about what does that bring up for them, how do they see themselves in relation to that. And men seem to see themselves as much more agentic in that, in the way that they relate to the elements, whereas women see it as something that's impacting them. And so,
I don't know the word you used.
Elements?
No, agentic.
Oh, agentic, okay. Meaning that they see themselves as in control or having control over it. So when they see, for example, I had one student who wrote about seeing, you know, sitting by a stream and seeing that stream as, oh, he could build a dam and irrigate a field next to it. And a woman sort of really, you know, sitting by a body of water and talking about how it brought her peace and comfort and this sort of thing. So just a really different relationship. I haven't explored that in my research, but it's certainly been a way in which I see feminism entering into that course as well.
Professor Tracy Craig. Now, installment number 3. Before she was president of Ireland, Mary Robinson was a practicing attorney. In this next piece, Mary Robinson tells the story of how one woman can make a difference.
What I have admired a great deal is women from very difficult circumstances who take their opportunity, who fight their case. Very often the lawyer is only there because there's somebody else who has the passion that they want justice. And one case that I remember particularly because it had such an impact afterwards on access to justice in Ireland was the first case that I took to the Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. It was on behalf of a very poor woman in Cork in the south of Ireland. She had a small stall in an open market where she sold fish and some other products. And she complained that over the years her husband had assaulted her, he'd beaten her. She'd at one stage been able to take a case in the district court, the lowest court, and he had been convicted and he'd been fined. And life went on and she complained that she was still being beaten and harassed, etc. So she decided that she would get a judicial separation. There was no divorce at that time in Ireland. There is now, but there wasn't then. So all she could do was go to lawyers and say, please, can you take my case? I want a judicial separation, and here's the case that I have, and this is why, etc. And a judicial separation was complex. You could only do it in the High Court. And for the lawyers, there was nothing in it for them. She wouldn't be able to pay them. The case would take a long time. It would be in the back of the list. There was no priority for family law cases at the time. So for a variety of reasons, she just couldn't get a lawyer to take her case. And she wrote a letter. I have seen and have a copy of that handwritten letter. She wrote a letter to a body that she'd read about in the newspapers called the Commission of Human Rights in somewhere like Strasbourg, and she probably didn't even spell it right, but the letter got there. And the letter was full of irrelevant stuff, but it had the core that she had been beaten consistently by her husband, that he'd been convicted of a minor offence and fined, and that she wanted a separation, and that she couldn't get a lawyer to take her case. So the legal department of the Strasbourg Commission on Human Rights communicated, that's the official word, communicated this case to the Irish government. And the Irish government, in its response, in a sense, walked itself into difficulty because it said, the Irish courts are open to any citizen. Any woman can go into the Irish court and plead her case herself. And luckily, the Strasbourg court wasn't too impressed by this. It was like saying the Ritz Hotel is open to anyone, you know, you can walk in, except if you can't afford to pay the meal, you're not going to get very far. I hope nothing I said caused that, but anyway, to cut a long story short, we took the case and it succeeded before the Commission on Human Rights and we went before the Court of Human Rights. And thanks to this woman, knowing that she had a right to justice and being determined to get that access to a court that would give her justice. The Court of Human Rights determined that Ireland, as a country, was in breach of two articles, Articles 6 and 8 of the European Convention, and Ireland, being a country that wanted to fulfil its obligations, immediately said that it would introduce a system of civil legal aid. So one woman was responsible for access to civil legal aid for all of the women who followed. One woman who never went to secondary school, never went to university, knew how to write a letter to assert her rights. I must say she was somebody that I honour very much.
Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland. She was speaking at the University of Idaho in 2007. I'm Madam President. Like Mary Robinson, Rebecca Miles was the first woman leader of her nation. She was the chairperson of the Nez Perce tribe. Rebecca Miles talked about the double standard that she experienced in that role.
Where I got a lot of opposition, and including the 2 years that I served as chair, was surprisingly not from the group that I thought I would get. The challenges that I got were from women. And I see that in our country. I had many phone calls. I had a few phone calls that were, you consider them, you know, a life threat. There's nothing glorifying in being the first woman. There is not. They talk about breaking the glass ceiling, and there's, so you, let's say you just imagine going through the glass ceiling. Well, you're taking some cuts along the way, I guarantee you. And I was thinking the other day of how they were criticizing Hillary Clinton. She had a real pretty shirt on under her suit jacket, but it was just too low for... And I'd noticed a lot of that criticism was coming from women. And when I was thinking of the keynote speech today, and I was thinking of when we were talking about the Dixie Chicks, how much of that criticism came from women, from our own women, when... We fight for these roles and we fight for equality to know that that comes with everything. There's except for, there is no exception. It comes with supporting the entire role, entire role, whatever that may be. And I could relate entirely with how being labeled, with either crying or, I know, and Yolanda probably remembers our chair before. He's a good friend of mine. He would get emotional, a man, get emotional, tearful. That was never viewed as being weak. If I would get emotional, and when I would get emotional, I would get emotional over the settlement, to the thought of what has happened to our people and the time. And so when I would get emotional, especially from women, it was just a sign of weakness. And that I always thought this was so intriguing to me. I could look at it as intriguing and not take it as hurt, that this is intriguing to me. This would be a nice area to study and to see what, you know, what creates this, what causes this reaction. There is a part where you have to accept the reality. There is a different standard. There is.
That was former leader of the Nez Perce tribe, Rebecca Miles. She was in her 20s when she was elected chair of the Tribal Executive Council. Now, since today's show is a collection of short shorts, we're already up to installment number 5. Jessica Hawkinson, she's a firefighter. She works on an engine. That's what they call the equipped pickup trucks that go out to the fire lines. And she works on the one that her dad runs. She works side by side with her older brother, and she's been at it now for 4 years. There are more and more women firefighters, but they're still relatively rare. And Jessica Hawkinson is the only woman on her crew. Here's how it all works.
Well, it's not very glamorous. That would probably be the first thing. It's dirty, sweaty, nasty, hard work. It's It's the hardest work I've ever done in my life. Every day, it's like 12 to 16 hour days. And you have to wear all of your PPE all day long, every day. Your hard hat, your long sleeve, Nomex shirt and pants, socks and boots and gloves, and our fire shelters. And that's a pack that we have to wear. And it's just, I mean, different things every day. Digging line, digging fire line, running hose lays, pumping water.
It is dirty work. And in contrast, though, to that picture of Jessica, working on the line and covered in dirt, sweat, and smoke, let me paint another image of her. Now, I saw Jessica on break from firefighting a couple of summers ago when she went out to celebrate her 21st birthday. She was gorgeous, as I generally know her to be anyway, all curls and glow, and she was in her skirt and makeup and trailed by an entourage of guys. Her guy friends, fellow firefighters. What I saw was a bunch of young, wiry, strong men trailing a girly girl to the bar.
See, I don't feel girly. No. I feel very, especially when I'm out on fires, I guess. I feel very frumpy and blah. Yeah. Like my first days back off of fires, I just want to be a girl again. I just want to feel like a girl again. And I get all dolled up, and we usually will go out, because my brothers, definitely, because I fight fires with my two older brothers usually, and they will definitely, they want to celebrate being home, and so I turn back into a girl, and I let my hair down, and yeah. It's fun.
Put on the makeup.
Mm-hmm. Because when we're, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, because it's usually warm, and in the summer, if I'm not on fires, I am in a skirt.
Firefighter Jessica Hawkinson lives in Boise. From Fire to Water, installment number 6 is a reflection by Christy Schwartz.
Daddy, where does water come from? I must have been 7 years old when I asked him this question. He paused and looked up in the air, which meant his answer was going to take a long time to surface. My dad often takes long moments like this, which I found frustrating as a child. To avoid annoyment, I would focus my attention to other things, like owls hooting in the darkness and the cool air on my skin. We always seemed to talk more at night. After a moment, he sighed, looked at me and said, "The earth." I stared back at him as if he was a ghost. Was that really his answer? This was really much more basic than I was expecting. "But how?" I asked. Looking back, I suppose I was expecting something similar to Aldo Leopold's poetic rendition of atom recycling in his essay Odyssey. After all, my dad knew everything. "The earth makes it," he shrugged. I could have again asked, "How does it make it?" But I had been down this road with adults several times. I knew eventually the answer would be something like, "It just does," which in adult language translates as, "Give it up, kid, forget it." This is something I was never very good at. I suppose I'm still not. I realize what frustrated me most about my dad's answer was the simplicity of it. When I left for college, my water question, and many more like it, still nagged at me. I majored in environmental science, where I was able to learn scientific explanations for natural phenomena. I learned about the water cycle and that the earth, skies, and seas reformat atoms into and out of water molecules on a daily basis. I learned that my dad's answer of the earth creating water was not quite accurate. It doesn't create water, because water has always existed, or at least the oxygen and hydrogen that make up water always have. I learned of theories and tools that attempted to explain the world, like the Big Bang, carbon dating, and evolution.
The clouds get heavy and the rain pours down. Precipitation.
Science has done a beautiful job in explaining complex situations through modeling and theory. What I learned most during my 4-year degree is that I ended with more questions than I started with. The answers I found in science left my soul with an empty feeling. The answers I found in religion left a bitter taste in my mouth and seemed desperately anthropocentric. My original water question hurled me down a spiritual, metaphysical quest that I have still yet to return from. Where does water come from? I recently realized I have been asking the wrong question for the last couple of decades. My question to my father was really not where does water come from, but why does it form? And in the same matter, why do we humans form? To be able to truly answer where water comes from, where this world comes from, we give a person an ability to answer life's deepest creation questions. What or who created this place? How did it get here? When did it happen? Perhaps it was a little unfair of me to expect my dad to have a thorough answer to the mystical nature of our world without advanced warning. Still, my 7-year-old brain is alive and always questioning, even today. Why do we exist? Why am I here? And a million other why questions that adults love to hear. So Dad, or anyone else that may have an answer, I would love to hear it. Even a simple answer would be a good place to start.
Water circles, water cycles, water dances, watch it spin. As the water coming to us goes around and round again.
My dad has always made up stuff also to tell us girls. In my family, we called it storytelling, which is a polite word for lying, for just plain making stuff up. So when I say my dad's a storyteller, I do mean he makes stuff up. He's always done it. He used to tell us the same lies, the kind that you tell little kids and they laugh if they're gullible enough to believe you. And you laugh if they're gullible enough to believe you. And we grew up and he kept telling the stories even after we didn't believe him, so he could entertain us. Last summer I talked to him about his storytelling and I challenged him on it.
He told us all kinds of crazy stories that weren't true.
They were true.
What stories?
They were all true.
Yeah, okay, tell me a true story.
A true story. Well,
Since his stroke in 1991, Dad's not as fluid a talker as he once was. His gift of gab had been noted among his fellow salesmen, but he is still just as obstinate.
I don't believe anything. I don't believe you have a true story in you.
I do have a true story. When we were in East St. Louis, Illinois, we were all in absolutely one room. I went into the basement of the place, and there was clothing and all of that. And in there, I was with a boy that was about 14 years old or so.
Okay, this is a story that he's told before. My sister Sherry thinks it's true. And I think Daddy really thinks it's true, too.
And it was dark in there, and I saw footprints up the wall, over the ceiling, into a pit. And I do not know how long that pit was or anything like that. But that we got out of there. And I never went into the basement again, I don't believe.
But you lived in that house?
We lived in that house because my granddaddy was a kind of a minister to the people there. And he handed out food and everything to the indigents. And so... But I did not go into that basement again. And in about 2 or 3 weeks, we had left that place and went south to Tallahassee again.
Mm. How old were you?
How old was I? Probably 9 years old, I think. No, I wasn't older. I wasn't that old. I think I was 8.
Okay.
8 years old.
Well, that's Sherry's story, too. Sherry's favorite story of yours.
Oh, really?
My favorite story is the one about the lion in front of the fraternity at FSU.
Oh, good Lord, yes, I tell you. And it's still true. It just grew up.
Now, this story is one that we've been told for as long as I can remember. There's a life-size plaster lion on the lawn in front of one of the fraternities at Florida State University. Leo the lion. Now, Leo's gone now, but the family tradition of telling the lion story is a mainstay. While this lion was on the lawn, the frat boys would dress him up and paint him and decorate him for all kinds of different occasions. And every Christmas, the lion had a painted-on Santa suit. Every Christmas since before I can even remember, our family would go sit on Leo and take pictures. And the story that Daddy told us one time, very matter-of-factly, like you're just telling kids history that they didn't know, was that the lion once had been a doorstop, just as little as a kitten. He only got big by being painted over and over, and all the paint layers built up until he was so huge that Daddy now had to lift us onto Leo's back. It took us years to realize that this couldn't be true.
It grew up, and I don't know where they moved that lion, but I tell you, that was a fun lion to be in front of. It was, really.
It was
just super.
And Sherry has another favorite untrue story.
I know it's true. Yeah.
About over by the pool, not too far from there, the FSU pool. That's where they make the clouds. That's a cloud factory.
Of course. Of course, I tell you.
This is another of the many Let's Fool the Kids stories that Daddy would tell. He said that the steam rising near the FSU pool from the steam plant was the source of clouds. Now, I never believed that one because it was a lame story. So he started defending it. And then I knew he was in obstinate mode. So I let it go and enjoyed the ride.
Everything Sherry said was true, too. No doubt in my mind it's true. It's not for me to say, but it is so true.
Well, and then the last thing I'll ask you about your true stories is Mom said you used to tell us bedtime stories. Do you remember doing that?
Of course, but I don't remember any of them right now.
But you used to make them up.
Oh, good Lord. I tell you, some of them is true, and some of them is a big fabrication.
But I didn't remember that.
Well, I don't either right now. But most of them, I think, was true then.
They were like lion stories.
Yeah.
I've never been great at making up stuff like Daddy Ken. But I don't have to. I have his stories to repeat and to relive. His abilities always entertain us and make us laugh and bring us together in that intimate way that shared histories can. So who needs truth when stories can give us so much more? You're listening to Yin Radio. Today's show is called Short Shorts. It's a collection of short pieces that don't demand too much of our power to focus attention during these early days of summer. You can listen while you garden or sit on the deck or whatever. It's summer. It's a great time for short shorts. Installment number 8 is from poet and astrologer Maria Teresa Maggi. She compared poetry and astrology, two symbolic languages.
For me, as a poet, this is another symbolic language. It's metaphor is literally the equivalence of one thing for another. It's not a causal model. It's a model of equivalence. One thing is one thing that's completely unlike something else is somehow equivalent to it. What that means for astrology or a poem, say, for instance, is the planets are out there revolving around, but our connection to them is also inside us. Or like in some way the place that you were born in the informs who you are, you know, and also your parents, your gene pool. Well, this just adds another dimension to it. The place on the earth you were born in relationship to the way everything else was moving around as the earth was moving around is also a part of you. Or for instance, if you take a little tiny poem by William Carlos Williams, this is another way of looking at it. This is called The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's the whole poem.
Let's hear that poem again.
The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Now, the poem is literally about, here's a picture of a wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater, so looking very red beside these white chickens. But it also means so much depends upon. What does that mean? When you come to that, you bring your experience, you bring what you know about what the wheelbarrow does, who the farmer is, so
it
it's rained. It rained. It's both symbolic and literal. Poetry is both and I think astrology is both and. And perhaps on our path, our evolutionary path, we're trying to figure out both and. I mean, we didn't have enough of the measurement. We didn't have enough of the science, but then we went to the science and now that's all. Just because everything can be measured doesn't mean that's what it means.
Maria Teresa Maggi produces the radio program Star Garden Moonwatch at each new moon and full moon. You can find her program at krfp.org. More Symbology is in installment number 9. June Grant is an artist, a Maori woman, a native New Zealander. Her work is modern, but like traditional Maori artists, June Grant uses lots of symbols. In this installment, June talks about the first piece that she painted when she began to fight breast cancer. June describes the painting, which you can see at spiritwrestler.com.
This is called The Discovery, and this is the first of the paintings that I did in the series. And this is me in New York. In 2003, I was in New York with a friend, and we were looking at doing marketing up there. The Mercedes building, is it Chrysler building, was there. And so that's, I wear that as my tiara. So this pattern here represents the sea, Moana Nui, the Pacific Ocean. And there are two hammerhead shark forms there. And the reason this painting was significant to me was that I was lying in bed in New York with my hands on my chest watching a television documentary about, in fact it was a news item, and it was about a young woman in Utah had gone missing. Her name was Elizabeth Smart. And they couldn't find her. And I was lying there and I felt a lump in my breast. And I thought, is that a lump? No, that's not a lump. But the reason I could always recall Elizabeth Smart when I thought about the time that I felt, so it was a defining moment in my life. I thought something strange has happened, but I still dismissed it. And so the painting is about me in New York making a discovery. I found the lump in July and it was October before I even went to the doctor. So I thought, we don't get cancer in our family because we just, you know, we don't get cancer. And I didn't know anybody else with breast cancer, and there was no reason to believe that it wasn't just a normal little lump of some sort. So when the doctor, after the biopsy, said, I'm afraid it is cancer, I thought, who? I just stepped outside of my body and I thought, I wonder who he's talking to. He can't be talking to me. So until you have the surgery, you don't know how bad it is. And I felt as if I was drowning and I couldn't breathe properly. And so I was always breathing to the top of my chest. I went into a automated mode of just getting on with life and being happy and taking lots of photos in case I wasn't going to be around for long and all of those sorts of things. But so these paintings were painted in the cancer lodge when I had 6 weeks of chemotherapy and radiation, and I didn't know what else to do, and I thought, I can do this, I can paint this last set of images that my children will be able to realise, you know, what sort of a journey that I was on.
June Grant visited the Northwest as an artist in residence at the Evergreen State College in the spring of 2008. The painting that she described is from a series of paintings called The Journey. You can view an image of all four paintings of The Journey at spiritwrestler.com. When you go to that site, search for June Grant and then click on the painting to see the entire series. Installment number 10, Kelly Gilmore organizes meetings for astronomers. She knows how to keep her cool. Here's Kelly Gilmore about organizing meetings.
So you told me that you coordinate 25 events per year?
Yeah, about that. Yep. What do you do?
How?
I know. It's a lot. It's, you know, it's you can't take any shortcuts with planning, though. So you're always, you know, you have to go from A to Z, and you...
Yeah, then this is one of your medium-sized events?
This is a small meeting, actually, for us. Well, that's not true. It's 1,000. It's almost 1,000 people compared to what we had. We thought we were going to have about 700. So, right. Yeah, this is a nice small one, so it's not as rough. We have probably 8 parallel sessions going, which is at one time, which is nice. In our winter meetings, we have about 20.
Do you?
22 parallel sessions. So
That's good. Triple and about how many people? So give me
almost 4,000 for our winter meetings.
So do you need to go scope out the venues? Because they move all the time.
Yep, I do site visits all the time. So I go ahead of time. We go about 2 years ahead, then a year ahead, then 6 months ahead to plan out all the session areas, where we're going, what session's going to be where, and our general session and our exhibit hall. And so we do all the layouts for everywhere things are going to be. And then deal with all the local people who, you know, help us find volunteers and help us find, you know, things to do and all that kind of stuff. Science centers, amateur astronomer clubs that, you know, might come and participate.
Do you end up creating like a checklist of what, you know, some of the standard things I have to do to run any event?
Yes. Yep. You have a checklist, and then you have the customized list that happens for, you know, winter meeting if we have this division with us, or summer meeting if this division's with us, or if we're doing something jointly. So it's customized, but there's a standard. There's definitely a standard list, and then we add on to the rest of the things that go on for each division that might join with us. So, yeah, it's a lot. So I've got 2 new people that we're teaching, and it's funny because they're like, okay, I think I got it. I'm like, no. Don't remember this, because this is going to change when we go to this summer, or this summer meeting, or this winter meeting. It's going to be totally different. The core stays the same, but then, you know, everything else kind of changes.
So how many people do you have with you, I guess, on more or less permanent staff?
There's 5-6 of us, permanent staff. And then we've got 3 vendor companies that travel with us all the time, just because it's very difficult to change and get new vendors for each city, because then you have to tell them, you know, what our members like, and it's just easy to keep it because they know what they need.
So most people I've ever talked to who've run meetings tend to do very few or one-offs, so they're frazzled. You don't look frazzled.
Yeah, I try to keep it all inside. You know, you know, they always say, I'm like, oh, are you worried yet? No, I'm not worried yet. Because, you know, everything's correctable and things always work out and they happen. And, I like it. I mean, I like to keep busy. I like the difference and bouncing around. It's exhausting sometimes. But, yeah, I'm not like most meeting planners. Most of our vendors say, they're like, oh, you're just so calm. You're never really upset or never concerned. Last night, which is a funny story, they called. We were having our staff meeting, and they called. The valet called, and so I'm like, valet calling me for what? And so she's like, I don't know. So I said hello, and he's like, hi, Miss Gilmore. There's been an accident. like, in the car? And they're like, yeah. So I go downstairs, and the guy just turned too quickly and just smashed the whole side of the van. And he's like, I'm so sorry. It was just, I'm like, hey, it happens. No one was hurt. It happens. He's like, would you be that calm if it was your car? I'm like, yeah, I mean, what can you do? At this point, you didn't do it on purpose. He's like, I've never seen anyone like that. I'm like, you just can't get upset about certain things. I mean, you know, you pick your battles. I mean, there's things like, you know, I can go off on, but yeah. It's pretty easy. I'm pretty laid back.
You can go down. You can really come down on people and say, hey, this is what I need, and this is how I need it now.
Yeah. I've got the other side. Yeah. And it happens. I mean, it does happen a lot. It does happen a lot. But, you know, I don't, like we were joking, I don't start it. I just, no is never no with salespeople, you know? I'm like, no. Come on, you can make it happen. Yeah. So, I have both sides.
Okay, well, good.
This is the good side I like to always show. This is easy, because the stress is, you know, you don't want to get stressed or be upset all the time, because that just, you know, takes your time off your day and years off your life, and it's not worth it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you made it very enjoyable, and thanks for talking to me. Sure. Kelly Gilmore.
Thank you.
Kelly Gilmore is the lead meeting organizer for the American Astronomical Society. I met her at a summer joint meeting of the AAS and the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in St. Louis in May 2008. Installment 11, coming up next, features Rhonda Abrams, an author, entrepreneur, and motivational speaker. Her presentation at the 2008 Athena Women's Leadership Conference was on women entrepreneurs taking that leap into leadership. In this excerpt, she talks about the first step in taking the leap, having or cultivating vision.
Somewhere or another, I had a vision that I could be more than, you know, just a consultant in San Francisco, which is how I started. I started writing a little column in little local newspapers to try to get business. And through a friend, I met someone who worked at USA Today. And I had the confidence, and you'll see I have a lot of confidence, but not as much as you think. I mean, you know, there's still that pussycat somewhere in me. Mm-hmm. I'm allergic to cats, so that's probably not the best. Should have put a little puppy dog in it, you know. But so I met the man who was the editor, their business editor for the whole news service for Gannett and USA Today. And I met with him, and I said, are you going to do a small business column? You know, I'd like to do, I have written one. I had to have a vision that I could be a small business columnist for a newspaper like USA Today and for a news service like that. And he said to me, we're going to do one of these. We're going to do a small business column. I'm just not sure when. And so I said, because I could envision myself, and when he said, I'm just not sure when, I didn't say, okay, well, let me know if you do. I said, may I keep in touch with you until that time? It took me 4 years. Every 6 months, I called him for 4 years. And one day, he picked up the phone. He said, remember I told you someday we were going to do it? That day has arrived. He said, we need proposals from different people, and we're looking at them. But I can tell you, all you have to do is put something on paper, and you've got the job. So I wrote the proposal knowing I had it, because I had that confidence that came first from having a vision. And certainly, as an entrepreneur, and Linda can really back this up, the first step in sitting down and thinking about a business that you want to start is having a vision of it. Before you have a plan for it, before you do a feasibility study, before you do any of those other kinds of things, you have to have a vision of what it can be. Now, a vision is more than a dream. I mean, I take the new book, I sort of go from a dream to a vision to a concept to a plan, because you do have to go through those different steps, but it does start with a vision. I mean, a dream is a little bit more, you know, dream is this fantasy. You know, I might dream, you know, it might have something to do with George Clooney. That isn't a vision, that's more of a dream, you know, and there are dreams like that. But moving on from those, having a vision of who I want to be, that is something that I actively try to cultivate as I move on to new projects or new stages in my own entrepreneurial career. So that's the first thing.
Vision, the first thing for taking that leap into leadership. That excerpt came from Rhonda Abrams' presentation at the 2008 Athena Women's Leadership Conference. At the previous year's conference, Judy Parrish was among the panelists, and she shared hints at how to use networking to build your career. She offers some warnings, too.
Well, I can tell you that some of your best friends, when you're trying to make decisions, are going to be the people who don't think like you do. Okay, and I can trust her. When I call her up and just sort of run some ideas by her, I can trust her to tell me I'm wrong, you know, point stuff out, you know, that I haven't thought of, and to have a very different take on things. And it is incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful. So when you find colleagues like that who you can become friends with and who you can trust, you know, they can be a very, very important part of your network, and you sometimes don't know who they're going to turn out to be. I've found some very surprising people who have really, you know, look at the world in a different way. Here's another one. How many of you have had people have met people and started to become friendly with people who all of a sudden you realize that they're just going to suck the life out of you? Okay. That can happen professionally too. Okay, so remember that while you want to add value to everybody that you want to network with, you also have a reasonable expectation that the other person is going to add value to you. There are professional leeches who will suck up your time. If you are in a very high demand job where time is at a premium, you have to be selfish, and you have to be willing to put those people off. And it's very hard for us to do this. You know, anybody who reads Dear Abby, you know, I'm addicted to Dear Abby because I've been reading it since I was, you know, so I still read it, you know. But, you know, how many times does somebody write in and say, I've got this friend who's just coming around, and basically the answer is the same, you know, get a spine. You know, it's just very, very hard for us to do that. I don't know if it's harder for men to get rid of leeches than women. I suspect it's not as hard for men, but I don't really know. But that applies professionally too, and it's tough to do it. But you know, you want to be gracious, but you just need to be very firm about it. That if you think somebody is trying to ride on your coattails or get information from you, that they're not going to be in an exchange, you just can't. You just don't have time for that.
Judy Parrish at the 2008 Athena Women's Leadership Conference. And we've done a dozen installments, and it's not over yet. Installment number 13 is from a powerful, creative woman who I met in San Francisco, Rodessa Jones. She directed the classical play Lysistrata at the African American Shakespeare Company. The play is about women resisting war and using the power that they had at their disposal in early Greece. That power is sex. Rodessa Jones was the perfect person to direct the play. She works with incarcerated women. She's the creative director of the theater group Cultural Odyssey, and she's an accomplished actress and director. I talked with her about Lysistrata and what Rodessa had termed ritual resistance.
Mm-hmm. About ritual resistance?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
I think it's just about taking a stand. As a woman, finding a place to stand. I mean, all of my life. I mean, I was born, I'm a child of the 60s. And it's about raising hell. It's about in whatever medium, whatever way you can. Make some noise, have an opinion. You know, I think that this is an amazing time to be a woman, to be alive. And at the same time, it is an incredible challenge to step out of our comfort zone for us who marry properly or, you know, even just get that great job and the lovely little house. And, you know, I know a lot of my contemporaries feel like they've done that. They've done the whole thing of the draft resisting, the 60s, the protesting, and I don't think it ever ends. I think we have to, as women, mothers, daughters, and sisters, do our part to make sure there's a place left for our children. Make sure the planet is halfway healthy and safe for those people that come behind us. Yeah.
There are Native people who've said women are the peacekeepers, women are the peacemakers in the society.
Mm-hmm. I believe that. I believe that. At the same time, working with incarcerated women, that there are miles to go to restore the heart and the souls of women who've been so incredibly damaged by an indifferent culture. You know, so because I'm an artist, I am constantly building places of concrete memory, resistance pieces, making work that speaks to the fact that we owe it to ourselves and to our daughters to be strong and be fierce. You know, we may be the peacemakers, but there is, as Mr. Shakespeare says, hell hath no fury. And to get in touch with that, again, back to my work with incarcerated women, it's been an incredible gift just to watch that kind of energy when you're in a jail, and watch that kind of energy with women. Just, you know, women, if they are forced to be silent, to be still, pictures fall off walls, chairs fall over. That kind of fierceness, it permeates everything. And for me as an artist and as a sister girl who is interested in moving the culture of women forward, I'm constantly trying to get women in touch with that. You know, in touch with, because it's okay to be angry, but now what are we going to do? We can't self-destruct. How do we use that anger to make changes in the world? And as in this Estrada, we are very alluring to men. I think that, and I don't know if that's always good, but I think it's like they're very, very curious about who we are. And I think that we put ourselves in harm's way when we go soft and limp. I think that we have a better chance if we just come out swinging. You know, come out swinging, and we're not having it. We're not having the rude language. We're not having the pissing on the furniture. We're not having this incredible this incredible disaster that has been set in place by the testosterone. You know, to put it in that way. Yeah.
Lysistrata is the power, though, asexual, and that's not all we are. I mean.
Yeah, but you gotta remember that's
that
a
was a play.
Well, it's a 2005. Yeah, which for at times I think was an incredible idea.
Yeah.
Now, of course not. Of course, but just the very act that this is the very idea that Lysistrata was spending her days thinking about, what can we do? What tool is available to us? Yeah, so that's, you know, that's it.
That's kind of back to what you said earlier, just raise hell no matter what.
Yes.
Whatever venue, platform you have, use it. And if
yes.
that's the only platform, that's
yes.
okay.
And this is a classic that I bow to traditional theater and to all the Lysistratas that have gone before. It is a classic, and back to the African American Shakespeare Company. They're really interested in how can we keep things intact, deal with classical language, deal with the intellectualism of it, and at the same time, what interests me is how do we make it as diverse as possible. So that's just Lysistrata in a little, you know, a capsule. It's like, yes, it is that, but it is power.
Rodessa Jones, actor, director, and creative director of Cultural Odyssey in San Francisco. I spoke with her in early 2008. We have time for one more. We'll wrap up this collection of short shorts with one of my favorite topics, wine. Winemaker Coco Umaker of Clearwater Canyon Winery sounds like an artist when she describes the techniques of winemaking.
How the winemaker can really affect style for different wines, even how hot they like to get the fermentations, how long they like to run the fermentations. Some people like to do them at a cooler temperature, which prolongs the extent of the time of the fermentation. Some people like to go short and hot. Choosing your yeast differently. Different yeasts will behave differently and ferment more vigorously at the beginning or the end, or just be slow and steady. There's a lot of variation you can get there. Mm-hmm. And mixing the grapes. So as they ferment in here, we'll come in 3 times a day and punch this down. And when I say punch it down, I mean, as the grapes ferment, the yeast produce CO2. And those CO2 bubbles will carry the skins up to the surface of that liquid, and they'll start to collect up here. And that's what you see here on top right now, is all the skins are kind of floating on the top of the surface being held up by the CO2 bubbles.
Makes sense.
And we come in 3 times a day and we mix that cap, this layer, back into solution. And that releases a lot of the heat that's been trapped in there and aerates the solution to kind of help the yeast get a breath. We call it yeast CPR. And it helps get extraction from the skins, and it's very, very important for us. Mm-hmm. I'm sure all people, all winemakers kind of have their own protocol for punching down and or pumping over. They all call it something different. We'll have to taste, of course.
And we did get to taste wine after that. Coco Umaker was actually punching down the wine as she recorded that for Yin Radio last fall. So we managed to fit 14 short pieces into this one show. Short shorts for summer. Let's end with some short songs from Linda Liu and Michael Rige. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or sign up for electronic newsletter at yinradio.com or yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Please drop us a line anytime at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. Installments for this show were produced by Anna Maria Roque, Sandy Billings, and Brittany Peralt. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat, and I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks so much for joining me.
Furs and pines and paintbrush and that big old dogwood tree. Out in the woods alone with you is where I want to be. Ought to wake up in the morning and open up my eyes. First thing I'll see is my lover and the colorful sunrise. Honey, let's not go to work today, 'cause all I do is long to get out my flute and your guitar and fill our day with song. Ought to wake up in the morning and just stay right here with you, just to fill our days with music. Nothing I would rather do.